Good morning, everyone. I call this joint meeting of the House and Senate Education Committees to order. It is 8:03 a.m. here on Monday, March 30th. We are in the Bette Davis Committee Room here in the State Capitol Building, located in beautiful downtown Juneau, which unfortunately is experiencing more snow. I want to ask folks who are here in the room if they could please mute their cell phones. Documents for today's meeting have been distributed to members. They are uploaded on BASIS, and there are additional copies by the door. Just be aware, it is a 70-page slide deck, so I encourage you to print double-sided. Members present today are President Stevens, Senator Bjorkman, Senator Yount, myself, Senator Tobin. We also are joined by Co-Chair Himshute. I believe we'll be joined shortly by Co-Chair Story. We have Representative Dibert, Representative Elam, Representative Schwanke, Representative Underwood, and Representative Eichheit with us as well. Please let the record reflect we do have a quorum to conduct business. I want to thank the Juno LIO, Jude, here today with us, and Mary Gwen from Senate Records for documenting today's meeting. I also want to note we have been joined by Senator Kawasaki as well. All right, on the agenda for today, we have a presentation from representatives from the Alaska Council of School Administrators and their affiliated organizations. We will begin with an introductory slide deck with Dr. Parody, the Executive Director of the Alaska Council of School Administrators. She is also joined by the Alaska Staff Developmental Network Professional Development Director, Doug Gray, the Alaska Educator Retention and Recruitment Director, Jennifer Schmitz. We also have with us several principals and superintendents. I do want to let members know that Dr. Parody has requested that we hold questions until the end of each set of presentations. So if you want to just flag me down, I'll keep a running list of who has questions, but we will begin those questions after the end of each presentation. Dr. Parody, if you'd like to join us here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Lisa Skiles Parody. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Council of School Administrators. Very excited to be here today. Thank you again for the opportunity. This has become a really good tradition, I think, to hear from the field, from our members who are doing the work. And very excited to have two of our divisions, the Alaska Staff Development Network and the Alaska Educator Retention Recruitment Center, share some of the ACSA focus. We're a 50-year-old private nonprofit and have been serving education leaders all of that time, and we're going to hear from some of them, our affiliates of the Alaska Superintendents Association, the Alaska Association of Secondary School Principals, the Alaska Association of Elementary School Principals, the Alaska Association of School Business Officials, and the Council of Administrators of Special Education. And we're really delighted to have CASE with us. This is their first year being part of the ACSA family. And, of course, I think we understand how important special education is in Alaska right now. And hearing from them, I think, will be really valuable. So with that, it's a mouthful of the folks that come together and work together, but the beauty of the unity and that collective voice, I think, makes this really strong in terms of advocacy and support for our children in Alaska. And we do that really through our work with the joint position statements. All of those groups come together and work together for months on what are the highest priorities in public education right now. So all of you have had a copy of this. I think you might have another copy of it. But you'll see that the presentations are organized along some of those policy positions and through the lens of those doing the work in the field. I just want to close my time with, you know, we have some similarity to your roles. We, I think, as districts represent specific interests, specific needs by district. But at the end of the day, our members represent all children, and we're concerned for all children in Alaska. There's no room for division. We talk about that between urban and rural and large and small, on-road, off-road, all of those need to fall to the wayside when we're talking about the best interest for our children in Alaska. And I'm really proud of our members because they think along those lines, and I think through our organization work really hard to keep that at the forefront of the work. So with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Gray.
Before you begin your remarks, Mr. Gray, I do want to let the record reflect that we have been joined by Co-Chair Story at 8:06 a.m.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Douglas Gray, and I serve as the Professional Development Director for Alaska Staff Development Network, which is a division under Alaska Council for School Administrators. Our work focuses on supporting educators across Alaska so that they can better support children in every community, urban, rural, and remote. Each year, we serve thousands of Alaskan educators through our professional learning, over 5,000 registrations annually, and more than 2,000 educators participating in our many online and webinar courses. We also put on the largest educational conference in the state each January. We provide practical, high-quality training that helps teachers improve instruction, support students, and maintain their certification. At the core, our work is pretty simple. When we better support our educators, we improve outcomes for all of our students. Today, I would like to briefly explain MTSS. It is our multi-tiered systems of support. Despite the name, MTSS is not a new program, it is not a mandate, it is not a curriculum. It is simply a common sense framework for organizing how schools support students so fewer students fall through the cracks and resources are used more effectively. At its heart, MTSS ensures three things. It ensures that we identify students early, we respond quickly, and that we match the level of support to the level of need. Historically, schools have often operated under what we might consider a wait-to-fail model. We saw students struggle, we monitor, and then only after problems become significant, then do we intervene. By then, academic gaps have widened, behavioral issues have escalated, and the solutions required are far more intensive and more expensive. This approach carries a high cost, not just financially, but in lost opportunity for students. MTSS flips that model. Instead of reacting late, we react early. We think of it as preventative healthcare. We do not wait for a condition to become critical. We involve teachers and families from the beginning, and we identify early signs and intervene before it worsens. And most importantly, students move between levels based on data and not labels. Let me just use two examples. We have Emma, a second grader. The teacher notices early reading struggles. She receives small group supports within a few weeks' time. Within 6 weeks, she's back on track, no special education referral, no long-term intervention. We have Marcus, a 10th grader. He begins showing behavioral issues. Instead of punishment, the school looks deeper. They discover the root cause, academic frustration. With targeted support, his behavior improves and he stays engaged in school. These are not exceptional cases. This is what happens when systems are designed to respond early. MTSS directly supports Alaska's key priorities. We have the Alaska Reads Act. MTSS provides the structure schools need to deliver early interventions effectively. Fiscal efficiency. Early intervention reduces the needs for costly intensive services later. Teacher retention. Teachers are more effective and less burned out when they have the systems and the tools to support students proactively. And rural applicability. MTSS is flexible. It works in small, remote schools just as well in our large urban districts. The bottom line is that when MTSS is implemented well, we help educators respond early and more effectively so that every child has an opportunity to succeed. Again, this is not about adding something new. It's about organizing what we already do. We just do it better. To support this work, this year we are partnering with the University of Alaska Anchorage and districts across the state through an integrated MTSS consortium project. This is a grassroots effort that focuses on developing academic supports, behavior supports, and mental health resources. Our aim is to develop statewide resources systems so districts, especially smaller ones, do not have to do this work alone. Recently, we just completed our statewide needs assessment. Educators consistently tell us what areas they are looking for: classroom management, literacy and math instruction, mental health, special education, and an increasing responsibility use of AI in education are one of our top selections. These topics can all point back to an MTSS framework and allow us to address many of these needs in a coordinated way. Our work is year-round. This spring, we will be hosting our annual Alaska School Leadership Institute, which supports leaders meeting to collaborate while receiving small doses of professional development. This year, we are focusing on the evidence of impact, relationships between culture and trust, and understanding and supporting their MTSS framework. We also will be offering numerous workshops that support many of our new to Alaska educators in multi-grade instruction, math, reading, and classroom management. Moving forward, we will continue to provide professional learning opportunities that align with these priorities, supporting educators so that they can meet the needs of Alaska students. Thank you for your time and your continued commitment to Alaska students.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Gray. I do want to just applaud your work with the University of Alaska Anchorage Psychology Department. I think the professors and, of course, the alumni of that program are exceptional. Are there any questions from committee members? Representative Eichein.
Thank you, Chair Tobin. Through the chair, Mr. Gray, I have two questions. One is, yeah, I'm over here on the side. One is, you talked about, you know, professional development and the importance of that. So the first question is, how has that changed over the years, especially in a fiscally constrained environment? And the second question is, Emma and Marcus. So I taught for 25 years, and what you described there with MTSS is an idealized situation that all teachers, all teaching staff want. How does that idealized situation with Emma and Marcus that you described, which I support, which we all want for our kids, how has that changed as class sizes increase?
Through the chair. Representative, well, to answer your first question, I think what we've tried to do is be more proactive in how we deliver our message. So we do a lot more virtual, a lot more Zoom meetings, Zoom trainings. We try to coordinate with other opportunities so that if people are coming into Anchorage or Juneau or something, that we're pairing it with something else so that people aren't having to continually travel. But we really found, the other part that we're looking at is we're working with some of our trainers and our presenters to develop some asynchronous models, so to do some videoing so that people then can watch it on their own time. So we've just tried to adapt to being able to allow those educators to meet their needs at their own time. So that's one of the big lifts that we've been doing. To answer your second question, you know, we recognize that, yes, that there is definitely a growing need for supports with the increased size that's happening across the state, with regardless of where you are in Alaska. You know, it's not an easy answer in the sense of, like, it's just a quick fix, like we provide a training. But what we try to do is that we try to look at what are the best practices, what are the resources that we do have available, and how can we implement those to reach those teachers. So it really is a thoughtful approach to trying to deliver a message and strategies that we think, well, that we believe are the best way to help support those teachers. So it's a collaborated effort that we try to do to support that, because we recognize that it is hard when you have 30 students in your classroom.
Follow up.
Yeah,
just I think on the first answer made perfect sense to me. The second answer, I guess I'll just rephrase the question. Are Emma and Marcus more likely to fall through the cracks as class sizes increase? I think I know the answer, but I want it for the record, please.
Through the chair, yes, there is that potential that students, regardless of what's happening in the classroom, that when we are reaching capacity in those classrooms, yes, those students still could continue to fall. We would just hope that we would have that framework available to catch them sooner than later. So they, you know, it is a hard question, and yes, there is that potential.
Thank you.
Rep. Elam.
Thank you. I appreciate the presentation and everybody coming out today. We've heard a lot about enrollment numbers going down, but yet we also hear about classroom sizes going up. How does that correlate with it?
through the chair. I'm sorry. Could you repeat your question?
With enrollment numbers going down, why is it the classroom sizes are going up, the number of students in a classroom?
Okay, sorry, through the chair. I think that's a financial issue that schools are still trying to utilize the resources that they have that are limited, and so that unfortunately, you still have to, we have to provide services for students, and with less dollars, we do have to, still provide the education, and so we don't have a lot of space to put. We don't have a lot of teachers left to be able to fill those classes.
I see Dr. Parody wants to add to the response.
Thank you.
Dr. Parody.
Through the chair, Representative Elam, thank you for the question. And we have some experts in the room who will be testifying shortly that are going to walk us through those pieces specifically. So some of those, I think, will be more clear at that point. But I would just add that when we're in an education shortage crisis that we're in, and you all recognize that, trying to staff classrooms, even with in drops in enrollment, becomes really challenging. So if you start with a number of teachers, or classrooms without a teacher, you are field adjusting until you can figure those things out. So I think you're going to hear a lot about how that's done specifically and why sometimes that is the case, if we can delay that until then. Doug is our expert in professional development and has been a longtime principal, so he too has had to manage some of that, but appreciate.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for that. I do not see any more questions at this time, so we can go on to our next presenter, Jennifer Schmitz, Director of Alaska Educator Retention and Recruitment Center. Welcome, Ms. Schmitz. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing us to have this opportunity to share some stories with you this morning. For the record, my name is Jennifer Schmitz, and I am the director of the Alaska Educator Retention and Recruitment Center, which ARC, and we are a division of the Alaska Council of School Administrators. I believe some of you have seen this slide before, but it's just a really good reminder that we are in a crisis time right now with teacher turnover and principal turnover, and this shows some data from 2013 until 2024, and you can see that we are just still not on the best trajectory as far as our openings. Teachers are at about a 30% turnover, and principals in Alaska up to 35% turnover. And this next slide shows exactly that same information, but has it broken down by different areas: urban, urban fringe, rural, hub, and rural remote. And I think it's safe to say, like 10 years ago, it was a lot harder in rural remote areas to fill teaching positions, but you can see that it's actually becoming just as big of an issue in our urban areas as well. And then our principals, however, is still quite a bit higher in our rural areas than it is in our urban areas. But 55% and 44%, those are big turnover numbers that we're looking at. So our reality, this slide, we did some research and surveyed our members. We had 345 positions that were not filled on the first day of school this year. We currently have 573 teachers that are working on visas, international teachers, and we also started the year with 285 teachers on emergency, or 285 people on emergency certificates, and that can be for a number of reasons. Emergency certificates are district-sponsored certificates where a district person, a superintendent, can say, we don't have somebody to fill this position that's necessarily qualified right then, and so they can give an emergency certificate to that person. And some of our international teachers have to start on emergency certificates, too, until they've taken their tests. I've shared this slide before, and I would like to say in a perfect world, these would be zeros. We would not have any first day vacancies. We would not be relying on international teachers, although they're doing great things in our districts and becoming part of our communities. But we would love to fill our schools with teachers from Alaska first and foremost, and in country, but we're just not able to do that right now. And no emergency certs. Yes, we don't want those either. Mm-hmm. So about a year and a half ago as a part of, I was already working with Alaska Council of School Administrators. We talked with districts and we realized that along with funding, filling our positions, teacher turnover, educator turnover is their biggest challenge. So we developed the Alaska Educator Retention and Recruitment Center to start really supporting districts in their retention and recruitment needs. And we are doing a lot of these things. We are really have become the hub of teacher recruitment and retention for the state. We are, I know that you're probably all familiar with the work that started in 2020 with the governor's playbook, the governor's working group on teacher recruitment and retention, which turned into the playbook and gave a lot of really good recommendations for what we could do to help with recruitment and retention. And so as a hub, we're starting to put some of those things in place. And one of those was modernizing the recruitment dashboard and program that was run for years through the University of Alaska Fairbanks. President Pat Pitney asked if we would take that over because we do work closely with K-12 schools and districts. So we did do that. We modernized it. We have a new website. We have a new job board. We started a marketing campaign. We are supporting districts with their international hiring, screening, helping them find teachers, working through the visa processes. And then we are doing advocacy. There's a bill out right now that's sponsored by Rep. Fryer that has some more of those recruitment and retention suggestions from the playbook in it as far as advocacy. And I'll talk just a little bit more about a few of these things. Virtual job fairs, that's something that when I was a principal, we didn't do virtual job fairs, but that's what we're doing now, and we're having a lot of success for those with those. This is just a screenshot from one of our latest ones. The districts build their booths. We have had over 800 applicants at times, most of them from our international applicants, unfortunately, but we're getting some good teachers, and we're hosting job fairs throughout the year. We have four of them scheduled this year. We also just did, which was kind of exciting, the first ever job fair that was just for our university students in Alaska. So we had students from UAF, UAS, and UAA come and meet with superintendents and HR directors and get questions answered and practice some skills for interviewing, and we're hoping to get all of those teachers placed for sure. And I mentioned we have a new website. I would encourage you to check it out. We're really trying to modernize things and tell the story of teaching in Alaska. If you go there, you can meet some of our teachers. You meet principals. They tell you the story about why they're here, why it makes a difference to be a teacher, and the impact that you can have teaching in Alaska. And I mentioned our international teachers. We have 573 of them currently, about 230 were on J-1 visas this year, the rest on H-1B visas. There's some challenges there that I'm sure you're aware of. Our J-1 program sponsors are no longer allowing us to put J-1 teachers into rural and remote areas, so we really have to use H-1B visas for those rural remote areas. And there's a federal proclamation that put a $100,000 price tag on H-1B visas, so that's really out of reach for us right now. So we're working through that with our immigration attorney and helping support districts and finding international teachers who are already in the country and trying to get them to Alaska. But I mentioned that they're doing great things in our districts. The picture on the bottom left, Joby, is a teacher in the Yukon Koyukuk School District. Those are her students. She's been here for 5 years and has to go home this summer, and they went to the superintendent and asked for passports so that they could go with her because they do not want to lose their teacher. And I think it's just really a good picture of the importance of relationships and how this turnover that's happening year after year is hard for our children and our communities. And then the middle one is Catherine. She just got here this year with her husband and her son. She is currently teaching in Seward, Alaska. And some of the other things that we do to support districts with international hiring is we pick them up at the airport and we get them to the Social Security office and to the bank and to get phones and get onboarded before they're going out to the rural remote areas if that's where they're going. So that was a picture from in the middle of the night at the airport. One of my colleagues picked them up. And then we are try to be as responsive as we can to school districts. And they've said, you know, these teachers are great. They're coming in from other countries, but they don't necessarily have the classroom management skills that they need. So we've offered a classroom management class. We've had over 200 teachers take that the last couple years. There's also a Lend a Hand Club. Many of our international teachers are special education teachers, and this is a club that one of the special ed teachers from the Philippines started, and there's guest speakers, and it's just supporting our teachers and learning how to be a special education teacher in Alaska. And I'm going to end. I did talk just a second about our marketing campaign, and I'm going to end with one of the videos that we have playing across the country and in our state right now to show what a fabulous choice it would make to come to Alaska and teach.
To teach in a place like this, you got to think outside the box
and live outside the lines.
I mean, it's Alaska. It's a world away from the classroom I was used to.
Every day it's an adventure.
But it's the community that really makes it.
You're not just a teacher here.
You're part of the community.
A part of the family.
A mentor.
Not just for education.
But for life.
That's why you stay.
You get to do and be so much more in your students' lives.
You grow as a teacher in ways you just can't anywhere else.
In Alaska, you don't just teach lessons.
You change lives.
It is so worth it.
I know so many people who were just going to come for a year or two.
But they stay for a career.
Teaching here pushes you to be creative.
The classroom doesn't always have four walls.
Hiking, hunting, camping, it's a lifestyle. It's not just a weekend trip.
Adventure is part of the job description.
If you want a life and teaching career that's outside the ordinary,
teach outside the lines. Teach in Alaska.
All right. Well, I thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Schmitz. And I see already that I have a question from Rep. Elam and then Senator Stevens. Rep. Elam.
Thank you. The first slide you hit on answered the question that I had is what it was. And so I was just saying it was classroom sizes were going up because we're not being competitive in the marketplace. And so, yes. But thank you.
Thank you. Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Jennifer. So what can we do, what can you do, what can the University of Alaska do to encourage more young Alaskans to consider teaching as a career? How can we increase the number of young people going into that profession?
Through the chair, thank you. That's a great question. I mean, I think this programs, we talked a little bit yesterday about I'm drawing a blank. The high school kids, the Ed Rising program for students that are interested in becoming teachers that there are groups of that happening across the state. There are other Grow Your Own programs that different districts are doing on their own. I think it's important to start early and let students know that it's a great job. But I do think we have to start early. And part of the recommendations in the TRR playbook were things that help support that Grow Your Own. There's a PERS to TERS where our paraprofessionals can stay in PERS or transfer over to TERS without losing their years. I think that's important. There's some things like that in there. Showing that we're going to support our teachers and that we're investing in our teachers. Our students are watching that now. I know that they're watching the way that we are having to advocate for education year after year after year, and it's exhausting for educators, and we need to show our students and our communities that we support and value education with money and with support so that they'll follow in our footsteps.
Thank you. I see Rep. Hemschut and then Rep. Underwood. Rep. Hemschut.
Thank you. Through the chair, I have two quick questions. On the H-1B situation, what kind of timeline are we looking at? I know there's federal legislation in the works, but there's the how many H-1B folks would normally be coming in for the 26-27 school year who are paused or not coming, and working back from needing them by August 15th, can you kind of give us a timeline of that? And then I'll hold my second question.
Okay. Thank you, through the chair. This is exactly the time that we have to be hiring these teachers right now if we want them here by fall. We could even be pushing it a little bit late. So we are working with our federal delegation, Senator Murkowski and Senator
Sullivan have both written letters and are trying on our behalf to help us, and she's got some policy, a bill out, but we don't know what that timeline is. We want to get that lifted. We're looking with our attorney at some other options, other visa options, but it will have teachers here by the first day of school.
Follow up.
Okay, yes, the rest of that question, sorry. If we didn't have those barriers, I don't have an exact number for you, but I have quite a few districts right now sending lists of how many teachers they want, and I would say I probably have about around 50 right now that we want. But talking to a superintendent yesterday, they're losing 19 of their visa teachers this year, but they're not able to replace them because of the cuts that they've had to make in their district. So if we weren't facing as many cuts and having to raise class size and take numbers of teachers down, we would be having to put in a lot more than that even.
Okay. Follow up. Thanks. That's kind of bleak news. So thank you for sharing that. Mm-hmm. My other question is, trying to understand why we have the ATP job placement website versus using the state jobs board. Is there some reason that those jobs can't be posted on the state, or can they also be posted on the state job board?
Through the chair, I don't know the answer to can they be on the state job board. That would be something that I could look into. I don't know if you've ever taken a look at the job board. I mean, it's a lot more than just job postings. It tells about school districts. There's videos about the different areas to go, what it would be like to teach there. You can explore by area. You can explore by school district. There's lots of frequently asked questions for international teachers, for teachers in country. So I think that it may probably provide a lot more information than just job postings on a job board.
Quick follow-up. Okay, so through the chair also, by being district employees, are they state employees? It's kind of a tricky question, isn't it?
It is, through the chair. I don't know the answer to that.
Dr. Paradis?
Through the chair, Representative, or Co-Chair Hemshoot, thank you for the question. As you're well aware, each district does a collective bargaining agreement with their respective teachers. So the agreement is with the school district, but ultimately the legislature is responsible for all education. So yes and no. Is that helpful?
Very.
That's why I didn't know the answer.
Thank you. Rep. Underwood.
Thank you. Through the chair, I don't know if this would be for Ms. Schmitz or Dr. Paradis, because you've been here for quite a while, but just looking historically at teacher recruitment and retention, pre-COVID numbers seem to be first day vacancies hanging around 2-3%. And then for years and years, I don't know if that's your experience, but then post-COVID, they've doubled up to 5-6%. I don't know if was COVID the attributing factor into how does that play? Do you see any trends just from your experience on that front?
Dr. Paradis?
Through the chair, Representative Underwood, thank you for the question. And I think I would like to do a little bit more research on that and get you some specific numbers. But I would say that we've seen significant shifts in public education post-COVID. And so this very well could be one of those areas. We certainly have seen issues with our students, and as you're aware, and so don't have a specific answer on it. We'll get back to you on it, but definitely the numbers were lower prior to, and I think it coincides too with, and you'll hear from our LASBO president, you know, we've been underfunded for a better part of a decade, and I think because we don't have a retirement system, a lot of factors have shifted from the time in which we were the best in the country to now. And when you starve a system, I think you see the impacts of that. And while we are forever grateful for the work of the legislature last year and the infusion to the BSA, we know that we're still not caught up. And all of our costs that we have no control of over are rising. You know that in your own lives, healthcare, property insurance, liability insurance, all the pieces are increasing. We don't have the ability to raise revenue. Just the environment in which educators are trying to work has shifted significantly in Alaska, and we've lost a lot of ground. We're grateful for you starting to kind of pull us back up by the bootstraps last year, and hopefully we can continue with that trend. But I do think that's a contributing factor also.
Follow up, just real quick. This might be a little controversial question, but for kids that are in, like, the Ed Rising program, and they're watching meetings like this, I just feel like a lot of times we are talking about the daunting things that we're facing. What is the positive message that they're getting that makes them want to be an Alaska school teacher?
Through the chair, I think that's a great question, and I think in the next hour, when you hear from these amazing principals and superintendents and the passion that they have for the job they do, I think that that comes out every day in what they're doing. We just come here to have to tell the stories because we're trying to advocate for all of our children, but there's not anybody in this room behind me that doesn't love what they do every day. I mean, some days maybe, but that don't love as a whole what they're doing, and I have every faith that they're letting their students know that, and that it is a good job.
Through the chair, Representative Underwood, that is such a great question, and we don't mean to be bummers. I want to be real candid that Jennifer's exactly right. We have the joy of this work, too. That's why they're still here, because they care about children, they care about our state, they care about our future. And I do think when you see some of the incredible things that are happening, one example, when you come to our Alaska's Heart through student art reception Tuesday night, you'll see the most incredible art from students across Alaska, many of whom don't have an art teacher. It's incredible. And every time we do this event, I'm reminded great things are happening. And I think students feel the love and support of the people around them. I think it is our job to advocate and really help you to understand what it's like on the ground. And it's rough right now.
Thank you.
I'm going to take one more question from Rep. Dybert, and then we'll proceed.
Thank you, through the co-chair. Good morning. Thank you, Dr. Parody and Ms. Schmitz. I just want to, and I'm excited for the art show because I have lots of the art hanging in my office today. So looking forward to spending money for education. I just want to put this out there. I had a great conversation last night with an educator from my home community, and we were just talking about my question yesterday about Ed Rising and how we can get more of our students into these fields that want to become teachers. And, you know, the conversation wavered towards pensions, and I just want to put this out there. With our pension bill, I'm lucky enough to have a Tier 2 retirement, and I stayed in the classroom for over 2 decades. I'm not retired today, so at some point I will go back to the classroom. And I think that is what's happening now. This conversation with this teacher, she said, you know, about 10 years in, unfortunately she, you know, got a divorce, but she could have easily gone back home to where her family and friends are, but that retirement kept her here and teaching in Fairbanks for over 2 decades, and she's still teaching. And this is just one story. There's so many across the state where the pension will help keep teachers for a long time in our classrooms, and also attract teachers to Alaska like it did when I went into the field. And I just wanted to say that that's an important piece to this puzzle. Thank you, Co-Chair.
Thank you for your comment, Rep. Dybert. And now we will proceed with Principal Nogg. Thank you, Ms. Schmitz. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you. Hello and good morning. And through the chair and for the record, my name is David Nogg, and I am the proud principal at Golden View Middle School in Anchorage, Alaska. Go Suns. I'm equally honored to serve in the roles as president of the Alaska Association of Secondary School Principals and the president of the Alaska Council of School Administrators. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. This slide features my exceptionally skilled and dedicated secondary principal colleagues that I'm honored to serve and collaborate with. We are in an educational crisis, and we are doing harm to the children of Alaska. An urgent response is needed to address the dire vacancy rates and the need for in-person educators and support personnel across Alaskan schools. ACSA supports efforts to address significant delays in certification approvals, which hinder the timely hiring of qualified educators and lead to unfilled positions. We encourage the state to invest in the Alaska Educator Retention and Recruitment Center. This includes strengthening statewide and national recruitment, investing in mentorship and induction programs to support new teachers and leaders, and expanding professional development for veteran educators. Public education is the great equalizer, and Alaska's children deserve access to great educators. As you can see here, this is the substantial financial impact of teacher turnover. The cost of teacher turnover is massive in so many ways. When adjusted for inflation based on the Anchorage CPI, the cost of turnover per teacher is $27,200. In Alaska, high teacher turnover is directly correlated with poor student achievement, and our children are suffering, unfortunately. In the five lowest turnover districts, where the average teacher turnover was 8.7%, the average percent of students scoring proficient in reading were 85.8%, as compared to the five highest turnover districts, where we see 37.9% teacher turnover. The average percent of students scoring proficient in reading is 46.9%. The Rand Wallace Foundation study conducted in 2019 shows that the average cost to replace a principal is $75,000. Keep in mind, this study was done 7 years ago and not cost adjusted for this fiscal year. In the Ronfeld, Loeb, and Wyckoff study of 2013, students in grade levels with higher turnover score lower in both ELA and math, and this effect is particularly strong in schools with more low-performing and minority students. Moreover, the results suggest that there is a disruptive effect of turnover far beyond changing the distribution in teacher quality. We have seen a very large rise in mid-year turnovers, meaning after winter break. This used to be predominantly an issue in rural and off-the-road system schools, but we are now seeing this impactful effect in our schools across the state. Due to forced reductions, we don't see the same statistical impact because the data is masked by the substantial and repeated cuts due to the continual lack of effective BSA funding. Only one out of every four principals are in the same building after 5 years. This high turnover rate of building principals is costly in dollars, time, relationships, and most importantly, the impact on student learning. As principals, we have many duties. First and foremost, we serve as the conduit for district and state initiatives. But in a normal day, we're an instructional program leader. We're managing students' safety, scheduling day-to-day as well as master scheduling, hiring, recruiting, and retaining staff evaluations, helping staff increase performance, navigating numerous different labor agreements, improvement planning, communication across all stakeholders, community partnerships, compliance and reporting, as well as budget, in addition to our daily crisis management. Other duties as assigned, I can tell you this year, I was in service on how to drive a John Deere snowblower, and didn't learn that one in my program. But in addition, we do everything from, I'm the backup nurse, so I have to take a course through the state so that we can administer medication to our students who need it, restrooming life skills students, substitute teaching, whether as a teacher or a paraprofessional. And the impact is even greater in our rural and remote schools. ACSA calls on the legislature to provide and fund a public pension system or viable alternative retirement system that fairly compensates all district staff who devote many years to Alaska's children. According to a 2024 study by the Economic Policy Institute, The average teacher earns 26.9% less than other professionals with college degrees. This gap must be offset by providing an excellent benefits package, including a robust defined benefit retirement program. As you may have seen recently in the ADN and maybe other news outlets, we just lost two former teachers of the year for this exact reason. We conducted a survey this year as to why educators are leaving the greatest state in the land. And why they leave, first and foremost, the number one reason was lack of a defined benefit program. Second being better opportunities in the lower 48. Third, cost of living is exorbitant. Four, the uncertainty of education funding. Now, why they stay? Positive school culture. They grew up in Alaska or have family in state. They love their community. Or they're currently Tier 2 employees, although this cross-section is rapidly fading. The Alaska School Leadership Academy, ASLA, is a two-year program to support new-to-profession principals. This unique and premier peer-to-peer support program is the only one of its type in the state, and it serves 90% of districts. Through FY25, 350 mentees and more than 90% of Alaska school districts have been served since the beginning of this program in the school year 18-19. Specific to the program growth, it has quadrupled since its inception. And having been a mentor and seen firsthand the positive effect, this is an amazing program, and we ask for your support. In 2024-25, 60% of ASLA participants were from urban school districts, and 40% are principals from rural districts. All research shows that mentoring is among the most impactful levers to increase retention and recruitment. Thank you for allowing me to speak with you today.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I see that Senator Yent has a question.
Thank you, through the chair. So flipping back to slide 28, and it's okay if you don't have them today, but can we get a list of those five districts on each end when the opportunity presents itself?
Through the chair, yes, sir, we will most definitely get that for you.
Thank you. I have a question. You had said that it used to be we were losing our educators only in more rural areas after winter break, but now that is true in urban centers too. Could you elaborate a little bit, please, on why you think that is happening?
Sure. Well, I'm sure we can provide data for you and we can get that to you, but I'll speak to you just on what I've experienced in the last couple of years as a principal. Nearly every year, whether in my building or a principal that I'm supporting by way of our mentorship, we have lost teachers at the break. This year, I lost one, and it was one of my special education teachers, and that was very unfortunate, as you can imagine. We're just seeing a rise in staying confident in that education in Alaska is a long-term career. And so as such, people are forever looking for an opportunity because there is a shortage nationwide, and it isn't, and we aren't competitive.
Thank you for that. It also makes me understand a little bit more why our international teachers are so getting to be so well received and popular, because they come here with a certain timeline, and so students know that teacher is going to be with them for certain years, and the community gets to know them better. Am I correct on that?
Through the chair, yes, you are correct.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to remind you in the House and share with our senators, we heard testimony from the Bering Strait School District earlier, and you recall they have a high percentage of international teachers on their staff, and they are seeing incredible growth in those classrooms because those teachers are staying over time. And I remember some of you remarking on that with Superintendent Dodd when she was presenting. And so I think what you're saying, while we don't have specific research on that yet, is very true.
Thank you. I see we have two more questions. Rep. Elam. I mean,
I did not. Have
oh, sorry. I'm Rep. Aishide. Sorry about that.
The ease.
The ease.
Thank you, Co-Chair Story. Through the Co-Chair, Mr. Nogg, one of the things that we often hear is the impact of a great teacher in front of students and achievement. And, of course, the reverse corollary is probably true. One thing we don't talk often about, and I'd like you to make a comment on this as a principal, is we don't talk often about the impact of a strong leader, I mean a building principal, or a weak building principal on student achievement. So, sir, you just showed some really interesting information on turnover and student achievement, but can you specifically tell us your perspective? What does having a strong building leader, principal, do for student achievement, or vice versa?
Thank you. Through the chair, to your point, recent studies have absolutely shown the greatest effect size to the success of a school is directly related to sound building leadership, period. When you speak with educators, they will tell you that they don't quit a community, they will quit a leader. Whereas when you are solid in your craft, when you feel supported and you're able to function with the resources that you have, it creates a culture that, as mentioned in an earlier slide, is the number one reason why people stay in education supporting Alaska's children.
Thank you. I concur.
Thank you. Senator Yent.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, earlier it was mentioned that at one time Alaska was considered to be one of the best, if not the best, public education systems in the United States. Could you please speak to the timing of that and maybe some brief details on why you think things have changed?
Thank you. Through the chair, to your question, I'm going to speak from personal experience. As a born and bred Alaskan, having been through our amazing public school systems, and having attended Title I schools, I had amazing educators who were part of the Tier 1 and Tier 2 system where there was a future, where there was opportunity, where they knew that their work was valued and that there was fair compensation therein. When you're competitive with other states, you get first-round draft picks. When you don't have that level of opportunity, the inverse is true. And so I think the degradation year over year, and when we look at stagnant funding, the compound nature of that impacts the quality of leaders, teachers, paraprofessionals, and all support staff therein.
Follow up. If it's not today, at some point, could you please get me a copy of the source from where we were ranked number one or one of the top ones? I'd love to study the years and see what we were doing different. If you can't remember them off the top of your head.
Thanks. Through the chair, I appreciate that. That is an excellent request, and we will most certainly get that to you.
Yes, thank you, Senator Yent. I see I have Rep. Dybert and then Rep. Hemshue.
Thank you, through the co-chair, to Principal
Nogg.
Thank you. I'm looking at the slide before this one. My slides are messed up. Slide 29, referring to the mid-year turnover and how hard that must be on a school and for colleagues to see another colleague leave. I know that when I was teaching, when I had tough days or tough weeks, I would often go to my counselor in the building to just talk through the week, tough situations with kids, hard, you know. Are principals finding that you're helping to counsel teachers for that fall semester, you know, to encourage them to stay or help them out in any way so that they don't leave at mid-year? Thank you for that.
Thank you. Through the chair, yes, most certainly I can speak firsthand that the one of the primary roles of a principal is that of a full-time counselor as well. And most certainly we take care of everybody in our building. And there absolutely is an increase in stress-related issues, the need for support. And it really impacts educators' ability to bring the best version of themselves to school every day, right? And absolutely, it has become a major situation. But additionally, in so many of our schools, we don't even have counselors. I'm fortunate that I still do. But throughout the state of Alaska, that job function doesn't even exist as a potential resource for so many of our schools. And that's devastating.
Rep. Hemshood.
Thank you. Through the chair, Principal Nogg, I think your other role, if I remember right, was dad to Noah and Bristol. Yes, yes. So thank you for raising your family here in Alaska. My question has to do with something I've seen in the middle school in my hometown of Sitka. When we can't, you talked about the daily crisis management. And that can sound so dire. People think of a crisis like an ambulance call or something. In a school, a crisis is an educator who's pulled away for jury duty or can't come in and is ill for the day and you can't find a substitute. That constitutes a crisis. And in my elementary school, we would have volatile students who could shut down an entire classroom. And so there are lots of things that make what we would call a crisis in a school. My question through the chair is, in my hometown middle school, if more than one teacher is out, often the principal is pulled away from all other duties to substitute. If more than one teacher is out, then those classrooms are sent to the gym, and the principal is in the gym just managing the time of those students, which means there's basically no learning going on. How common is that? This is not a criticism. This is just a reality of what we're having to deal with. And I want to mention also this whole presentation, there are a lot of problems that we need to solve. And so I want to go back to my colleague's question. We've been celebrating from time to time here in House Education little highlights of great things going on in our schools. And that was an idea that she brought to us. So I hope that all of our future educators are not going to watch this today. I want them to go out and be in the schools and get that energy of what we are doing and what's working so well. But how does it happen to you that you're managing a couple groups of kids whose teachers aren't there that day?
Through the chair, thank you for that question. Yes, although I'm fortunate that I don't have to combine classes in my school that frequently. Undoubtedly, in my building, we have 12 to 16 substitutes a day. That's massive. I'm pulled away, whether it be to be the district representative to conduct IEP meetings, dealing with large issues, small issues, all of that to say that we see that level of absence rate in our schools because the vast majority of our teachers are Tier 3. There's not the same incentive when there's not a defined benefit program where you can continue to grind, and nobody grinds harder than those in public education. And when there's not a reason to continue to put others above yourself, to be centered on the altruistic reality of doing what's right by children, it makes it very impossible. And to an earlier question, when you don't have supports, when you don't have hope, when you don't have the same access to opportunity, or even reasonable for that matter, it does impact people's ability to day over day sustain the difficulties to make it to those successful days. And there are absolutely successes in every school in this state every single day. So,
quick follow-up, and then we'll need to move on.
Yeah, this is just a comment. I'm just going to say when kids are taken from their academic classroom and placed sort of in a congregate setting just to get through the time under the supervision of a single adult rather than actually learning, we cannot be surprised if our test scores are not where we want them to be. So we have a lot of problems to solve. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you, Principal Nogg. We will now go on to Principal Heather Kahn. If you could please come forward, introduce yourself for the record, and welcome. And I see we are having a couple of people join us. That's great.
Madam Chair, we had our president, Heather, in another country yesterday. So we had a backup plan. So you get the benefit of two amazing elementary principals.
Thank you. Yes, please proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having us this morning. Through the chair, my name is Lori Ruckstaschel. I'm the principal of Chinook Elementary in Anchorage, and I'm the past president of the Alaska Association of Elementary School Principals.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, good morning, and thank you for this opportunity to speak today. Through the chair, for the record, my name is Heather Kahn, and I'm the principal of Stedman Elementary in Petersburg, and I'm also the president of the Alaska Association of Elementary School Principals, as well as the Federal Relations Coordinator. This is our AAESP board. And our elementary association board collectively comes together to share their perspective, whether it be rural or urban. And today I'm here just to share our story with you about what's happening in our building or in our buildings across Alaska. My focus today, our focus today, will be about sharing the collective perspective of what it takes to be the principals and instructional leaders. So we're also managing grants, compliance, and implementation of major state initiatives. And much of this early education work, especially outside our larger big five districts, is falling directly on principals and small district teams, often without additional staffing. When we look at the Alaska development profile, we see a consistent pattern. Many students are entering kindergarten without the foundational skills they need, especially in early literacy. If you look at the slide, the phonemic phonological awareness is one of those crucial areas. We are seeing that play out in classrooms across the state, and this is not about effort at the school level. It's about access to early learning opportunities before students arrive.
We believe strongly in early intervention. We see every day that it works. We know that strong instruction, early support, and family engagement give students the best chance to read proficiently by third grade and stay on track long term. But to truly meet that goal, students need access to education earlier by age 3. And they need consistent instructional time and support before they ever reach kindergarten. That's why ACSA supports sustainable early childhood funding inside the base student allocation, including full funding for pre-K. Right now, that system is not fully in place, and that gap shows up in our classroom.
And for the record, this is Heather Kahn. I want to just share what this looks like on the ground. And in Petersburg, our district secured preschool funding through a grant, but only for 1 year. After that, we had to start the process over. And to access more stable funding, we went through the early education program process, which administrators, and I can contest to, have described this as more time-consuming than a school accreditation process. All of this work is done at the building level while still running a school and while doing all the duties that Principal Nogg just described in his presentation. After completing all those requirements, districts like Petersburg, Skagway, Valdez, and Mat-Su were told that funding was no longer available due to statutory limits. So the question principals are asking is, how do we responsibly build programs for students when there is no guarantee of funding? This slide right here shows statewide early literacy screening data from DIBELS, looking at the percentage of students meeting benchmark from kindergarten through third grade. We're seeing growth, especially in kindergarten. Kindergarten students increased from 23 to 62% between benchmarks in 1 year. And that tells us that early intervention works when students get the time and support. But even with that growth, a significant number of students are still entering and remaining below benchmark. As students move into first, second, and third grade, the gains become more modest. This tells us we're looking to catch up students rather than starting them ready. The data really shows two things at the same time. We're making progress in our schools, but we are starting too late.
Next slide. So for the record, this is Lori Ruckstaschel. At the same time, we're doing everything we can at the elementary level to meet expectations for student learning. That means increasing reading instruction, implementing what I need when time for targeted intervention and enrichment, and monitoring student progress closely. We are committed to this work. At Chinook, we implement school-wide WIN time to provide individualized intervention and enrichment for all students. We utilize all staff at our Title I school to run 38 consecutive WIN groups. That includes classroom teachers, specialists, support staff, both classified and certified. As a larger urban Title I school, I have access to more staff than my neighboring colleagues, even in Anchorage, and certainly more than our rural schools. But it is still not enough. From a principal's perspective, the issue is not commitment, it's capacity.
For the record, Heather Kahn, through the chair. We are being asked to do more, earlier, and at a higher level without the staffing time and funding to sustain it. If early literacy is truly a priority, then early childhood education must be funded in a consistent, predictable way, and the system supporting it must match the expectations placed on schools. In addition to the work of the Alaska Reads Act, if we want third grade reading outcomes to change, the system before kindergarten has to be built and funded to make it work. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. And I just want to note that when we receive presentations from Excel and Ed about the incredible gains that Mississippi and Oklahoma have seen, it was because they highly invested in pre-K programs and ensured that students had full day access to those high quality learning environments. So I thank you for your advocacy, as I too agree that we need to supercharge pre-K. Are there any questions from committee members? Representative Schwanke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, ladies, for being here. I heard you say that less children are coming into kindergarten prepared. And I'm curious what your thought is on why that is, and could it have anything to do with the increase in our infants and toddlers on technology instead of in front of books?
So through the chair, Representative Schwanke, thank you. That's a really good question. And I think that it's a pretty complicated question, but yes, we would agree. We are seeing across the board much shorter attention spans. There is some data out there recently that is sharing that students now have dropped attention spans to about 20 seconds. So when you speak to a kindergarten teacher at the end of the day and they're exhausted, not only are they trying to maintain attention throughout the day, but with higher numbers, it definitely is a juggling act. I think that we are seeing that it's not only access to technology at such a young age. The onset for use of devices is now shown to be 18 months. And even if the parents are doing what they believe, by even downloading educational apps, it is rewiring their brains at an early age to need quick attention span movement. In addition to that, this particular kindergarten class did not have exposure. These children in kindergarten right now were born during COVID. So during those early years, they did not have exposure to even things like playgroups. So we are seeing definitely significant delays in social skills, interactions amongst each other. So when we're asking kindergarten teachers to do large, substantial blocks of instructional time, they are noticing that even interactions among the peers are requiring a level of instruction and support around engagement, social skills, and SEL.
Quick follow-up.
Thank you. Follow-up.
Thank you for that. I would agree. All those are incredibly important. What kind of interaction would you say that principals and educators in general have with community members and parents of young children to help curb that?
Through the chair, Representative. We are working with our community. I can speak for us at Chinook and in Anchorage. We really are working with our communities to really give them exposure to community resources. When we see families that have younger siblings that are coming up through the system, we're encouraging them to speak with their general practitioners, to get out into play groups, get back out into the community, engage with others. You will hear later with the presentation from special education that we are seeing an increase in diagnoses and severity of diagnoses. So we're working with families to try to access those conversations early, prior to coming into kindergarten. So really we're working through in communications and networking and building relationships with our families.
Thank you. We now have a next question from Representative Diber, and then our last question for the slide deck will be from Representative Himshute. Representative Diber.
Yeah, thank you. Through the co-chair, thank you, Ms. Ruckdeschel and Ms. Kahn for being here and for being educators and for our youth throughout Alaska. My question is, how many teachers in your building have more than 10 years experience?
Through the chair. We are different in Petersburg. So most of the teachers that work there have been born and raised there, or their family, they have come in from their family being present there. And so the percentage, I can tell you there's two teachers that were not either born and raised there, or the teachers that were did not come in with other family in Petersburg. I would like to go back to a question that had come up about the interaction with community members. And in Petersburg, we have Title I funds and the CLSD grant that has come through. And so we are really able to take those evenings and educate parents and families as they come through the door. And so teaching them how to interact with their children, teaching them how could we have an interactive book read for them? How can we add an activity onto that book read so that they're engaging with their children? And when we do these nights, none of what we are doing is on a device or with technology. It is down on the ground, hands-on, one-on-one interactions between families and their children.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative.
Sorry, Lori.
Through the chair, just a question about the staff on tenure of staff. At Chinook, we have over half of our staff that has over 10 years, but I will say that the majority of those particular teachers are approaching retirement within the next few years. And so in speaking with them, they are looking at taking that retirement as soon as they are qualifying. So we are seeing younger and younger teachers as they're moving in and rotating.
Thank you.
Follow-up?
Very brief follow-up.
Of those master teachers, would you say they're measurably more effective?
Through the chair, absolutely.
Representative Himshute.
Thank you, through the chair. Just very quickly, in the course of your careers, have you seen the amount of recess time change? We've put in place certain requirements under the READS Act, and we always add to the plate of educators, and the time in the day to deal with that has not changed. And so have you had to reduce your recess times at any point? And I'm talking about not just in the last year or two, but in the history of your schools.
Great question, through the chair. Our recess, we have not touched our recess times. And I can speak for Southeast, where most of us have not touched those recess times. What we are touching to make all of this fit into the system is our gym time, our swim time, our library time, our music time, and we get music once a week. And so those are the impacts that we're seeing at our level, trying to mold it into a piece where we could maybe on Monday we could go to the library, and on Tuesday we might be able to have gym, and then on Thursday, and just kind of scaffolding it like that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And Dr. Parody, if you could follow up with us, I'd be curious of how many of your superintendents are able to utilize the community schools model and what additional resources might be necessary to work with community members to help not just the children, but the parents learn that screen time is not conducive for them as well. As we know, parents are the first teachers of our children.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Tobin, I know our members would agree with that statement. Parents and families.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. So, good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Melissa Matthews, Director of Student Service at Bering Strait School District, and I serve as the President of Alaska Council Administration of Special Education, CASE. This slide shows the 2025-26 Alaska CASE board members. These are special education leaders throughout our state. CASE is a professional organization dedicated to supporting and empowering special education leaders through advocacy, specialized resources, and a collaborative peer network. Next. I'm here today representing leaders responsible for one of the most complex and legal mandated parts of our education system, special education. Let me be clear, special education is not optional. Under the Individuals with Disability Act, where every child is guaranteed a free and appropriate public education in the least restricted environment, this is a civil right, and for school districts, it is a non-negotiable legal obligation. The process to identify students is rigorous, data-driven, and time-bound. Once a parent consents to evaluation, we have 90 days to assess, determine eligibility, and if qualified for a disability that impacts their learning, implement an individualized education program, an IEP. That IEP is a legally binding contract. Every service minute, every accommodation must be delivered, regardless of staffing shortages or budget constraints. In the eyes of the law, we do not have the staff or we do not have the funding is not an excuse. The liability rests entirely on the district. And the needs we are serving are not one size fits all. In rural Alaska, one special education teacher may be responsible for an entire school community, supporting students with intensive disabilities who require one-to-one to one-to-three adult-to-student ratios for physical safety and educational progress, alongside students requiring targeted interventions for dyslexia, ADHD, learning disabilities, and or behavioral, social, emotional challenges. We are also seeing a significant increase in early childhood needs. Three-year-olds are entering our school with major development delays, such as significant speech and development deficits. Serving them is a legal requirement and a major resource commitment. Early intervention works, but it requires upfront investment. By investing in the infant learning programs and early literacy, we can identify needs earlier and often reduce the intensity of special education services required in later years. It is both more effective for the child and more physically responsible for the state. At the same time, our special education teachers are being asked to do more than ever. They are educators, clinicians, legal compliance experts, and case managers all at once. This requires extensive training, specialized skills, and ongoing professional development. As you see in the chart, student enrollment has remained steady since 2021, but we have seen a significant increase of 14% in students with disability, and this is for the state of Alaska. We currently have nearly 200 unfilled special education teaching positions across Alaska. These are not optional roles. They are federally required. Within the state, we are starting to see schools without a resident special education teacher at all, relying on an itinerant staff who fly or commute between sites to supervise and train paraprofessionals who will be providing the specialized services to the student. This increased cost and stretches staff to their limits. It is not a model designed for student success. It is a survival strategy. We are recruiting everywhere, across the country and internationally. We are spending funds on travel, relocation, and visa fees, and still we cannot fill positions. Next. We are required to provide services like speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy, and psychological services. Due to national shortages, districts are forced into high-cost contracts, often relying on itinerant or virtual providers. But virtual services cannot fully replace in-person care, especially for students with significant physical needs. In many cases, our teachers are left implementing these services themselves, carrying both the workload and the liability. We are paying premium contract prices for remote advice, while the actual physical labor and legal liability falls squarely on the shoulders of overextended special education teachers in the school. What we are experiencing is what I would call a vacancy tax. We are spending more on workarounds, travel, contracted itinerant staff, and temporary staffing than we would on a stable, permanent workforce. Across Alaska, districts are doing everything they can to uphold the civil rights of students with disabilities, but we are stretched thin. We need the tools to move forward from simply surviving to truly educating, because an Alaskan student's civil rights should never depend on whether a district can find a teacher or budget constraints. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. I do have one question, as I had a school board member in my office indicate that with some recent regulatory changes in the department, the services provided are no longer required to be quarterly, but now monthly, and there is a virtual option, which has helped some of our remote and rural communities, but for those who provide those services in person, there's an additional cost being borne by the school district. Can you speak to that for us?
Through the chair. Yes, so with the regulation change, and it was geared more because of the rural areas to kind of relieve that cost of having to fly out an itinerant contract person. And it's up to them. It's up to each school district if they want to go that route, if they want to do just the virtual monthly check-in and supervision of the program with a special ed teacher and whoever's providing the service, whether it's a paraprofessional, they can go that route. Or, like many school districts are, I'm at my school district, at Bering Strait, we're doing a hybrid model, so we're still flying them out three times a year. But we're also doing the monthly check-ins with them. We just feel like in our area that it's, you know, having them come in and do the testing, initial reevaluation, we're going to get a better picture of what our students can and can do than somebody trying to test them virtually. So we're doing a hybrid model. But some schools, districts are doing virtual, so they're doing the virtual monthly or, you know, whatever it says on their IEP, they're doing that. Then they don't have to do that virtual if it's a related service, is actually providing the service if it's virtual or in person.
Thank you. And just to follow up, and you can always follow up with the committee at a later date about the cost. I'm curious about the increased cost to districts for this regulatory change. Representative Eichstein. Elam, I apologize. Back to back in the E's.
Thank you. I was looking at the data there on slide 45, and I apologize if you kind of already covered some of this, but that's a really startling climb whenever I look at that red line, and I'm just wondering, like, what's going on? Why are we looking at those steep climbs in a 10-year span? And is this, like, what did the previous 50 years look like? Or is what's going on? Like, what's happening with people?
Me to take it, and then you take it. Yeah.
Chair Tobin, through the chair, Representative
Elam.
I know that. Sorry. Thank you for the question. And we looked at this in our practice session last night. We looked at this for a long time because we were talking about what is the climb attributed to. And I already have it in my notes from last night. We're going to figure that out and share it with you. It's startling. Mm-hmm. We speculated it could be post-COVID. Mm-hmm. We speculated teaching shortage. Mm-hmm. Obviously, will have an impact on this. So we are going to do some further research on it. think that's what we know today.
I may follow up.
Thank you. Very brief follow-up. Yes, we'll have our last question by Representative Dieber. I apologize, Representative Weisshein.
Thank you. I'm just curious what the diagnoses, Representative Elam, for the record.
Through the chair. And so we do not have that broken down to disability categories, but I do know in our school district we're getting a lot more students with coming in, especially at the early childhood, with a lot of speech deficits and language. But we can look and see if we can get the breakdown of the disabilities if you would like.
I would love that. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Representative Dieber.
Thank you, through the chair, to President. Can you tell me I'm looking at slide 47. I know from a teacher aspect of it, there's meetings, you have the special education teacher does paperwork and then organizes meetings, and oftentimes these meetings are intimate, emotional, and trying to solve problems with families. And I'm wondering if those are virtual. And I'm also wondering, like, thinking about the previous presentation with the principals, with paperwork, does some of the paperwork of special ed students fall on principals in a building with these virtual educators that you're working with long distance? I'm just curious the workload of that paperwork on the building itself.
Okay, Madam Chair. So that's a great question. Some meetings are held virtual. If it's an itinerant SPED teacher, then wherever location they are at, they will hold it virtual. Usually the parent and the teacher and the principal will be together at the school, and usually it's a SPED teacher, special education teacher, that is the only one that is virtual. And as far as extra work on the principal, we would have to have somebody at the school print out the paperwork and get it ready, organized for the meeting. It could be the principal. It could be the gen ed teacher. It could also be the paraprofessional that's actually providing the service at the school.
Thank you. I just want to do a time check for folks. We have two more presentations in 30 minutes. Hopefully we will have plenty of time, but I apologize to committee members if I cut you off or do not give you time to ask a question. As always, I am sure that these fine folks would be happy to answer your questions when we are off record.
Through the chair and for the record, I'm Randy Traney, and I have the distinct honor of representing 53 school districts in the state I love as the president of the Alaska Superintendents Association. I'm also the proud superintendent of the Matsu Borough School District. I'm joined by my colleagues on the board of directors for the Alaska Superintendents Association, as well as many other superintendents, and some of our 11 new superintendents so far are in the Capitol, and if you have a chance to visit with them, I know that they would love to talk with you. The United States became a superpower because of public education. And our state, luckily, is young enough for the founders who wrote our Constitution to have known that. And so I think on this slide, we have the ability to, like, think about what did the founders of the state of Alaska, what was the primary thing that they put in our Constitution? And it was this constitutional duty to provide timely, reliable, predictable revenue for schools, and fully and equitably fund all initiative laws and mandates. They knew that because they'd seen that work for the rest of the United States. We know that if we have early notification of funding and predictable funding, that then educators can focus on student achievement. And I know that you all know that sadly in our state right now, we don't have that. There's three things I want to point to on this slide. First, if you look at FY25 and FY26, we are profoundly thankful to you all for the change in the BSA from 5,960 to 6,660. profoundly thankful. However, you look up in the upper right-hand corner, you can see that when adjusted for the Consumer Price Index from 2011, the BSA should be closer to 7,943, which leaves a delta of 1,283 in blue, right below that. This next slide is the exact same information, just the inverse. So once again, you can see the massive change in the BSA last year, which has certainly helped our situation. But when if we adjust it in dollars for 2011, the 6,660 has the buying power now of about $4,700. I often say that all boats rise and fall on the same tide. And for Alaska school districts, that tide is the BSA. It's the mechanism to fund the choices that we all value for families in our state. It's the mechanism that funds correspondence schools, charter schools, and brick-and-mortar neighborhood schools. It most importantly provides reliability and predictability for our leaders and our school boards across the state. And that's why this is so central to the ACSA, and you'll see it at the bottom of this slide, unity and advocacy for this one tide that benefits all boats. I got to go to school in Mount Eccles Elementary School in Cordova, and then I went on to the high school. My elementary school is now 71 years old, and it doesn't look much different than it did when I was there. And the same is true for the high school. It's now 58 years old. The average building in our state for schools is 45 years old, with 83 of them over 60. There's an incredible backlog of deferred maintenance, over $500 million and growing annually. The image on the left shows what the role of a superintendent should be. I like to think of that upper yellow part is implementing the vision of each school board. That's my job. I manage the people, I work with the community, and I report back to the school board. And at the center of all that are students and student achievement. But that's not the current role that superintendents have right now. Instead, we have the group of three bullets on the upper right. We manage school budgets and state mandates. We consider what to cut. And we monitor state and federal compliance. And instead of being the academic leader in chief, we're now the budget slasher in chief. What the role should look like is promoting academic success, implementing new programs and vision to promote academic success, mentoring educators to promote academic success, and building community relations to promote academic success. 3 days ago, I got to sit in a meeting with our new and incoming superintendents, and there were a bunch of other superintendents in the room, and we did a kind of a Kahoot where everyone scanned what is waking you up at night, and they just wrote down what's keeping them awake at night as leaders. You see a pattern in these words: managing operational funding, teacher turnover, in-kind contributions, staffing, facilities, wrapping up my current job because I'm leaving, the budget, visas, staff reduction, staff capacity, school, Washington, D.C., structural deficit, closing 3 schools. What's on our mind collectively is budget and money, and you don't see anything here about academic achievement. And that crushes people. It crushes our leaders. So if we go to the next slide. Research has demonstrated over and over that district stability and leadership promotes academic growth of students. But now across the U.S., the average superintendent stays less than 3 years, and it's far worse in Alaska. What the picture on the right represents are from 2018 to 19, people with blue hearts are no longer in the state of Alaska. People with yellow hearts are leaving this year. They're retiring. People with the purple hearts, they're still here, but they've switched districts, which means there is exactly one superintendent left in their same job from 2018-19 to now. It's Josh and Skagway. And look at Skagway's achievement. Yeah. My last slide is this. We recognize that problem as an organization, and we're trying to put resources into it. The new and incoming superintendent support program, we're already collecting evidence that students that superintendents who go through that program are staying longer. But could you imagine how long they might stay and what might happen if instead of being the budget slasher in chief, they all got to focus on being the academic leader in chief? I'm happy to take your questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Traney. And I do want to just ask for a follow-up off the record, Dr. Parody. The Task Force on Education Funding has received a proposal from AML on what they call a BFA, a Buildings Facilities Allocation, and we'd love to hear the position of your organization or organizations on that particular approach and if there's any feedback on that particular proposal. With
Madam Chair, I will get that to you. Nils Andreasen, the executive director of AML, is presenting to our folks regarding this, and we will engage in a discussion and get your feedback. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Young.
Thank you, through the chair. More of a comment than anything, but if you would like to give any feedback, that'd be great. But 4 years on the assembly, I cannot tell you how frustrating it was that we would have to adopt our budget locally prior to the state making decisions, and I'll just say that I do, and I know you guys feel the same frustration, so I hope we can find some consistency in education funding at the state level so that there's not that knee-jerk reaction at the district level with the pendulum swinging back and forth on who we're hiring and who we're laying off on a daily basis.
Thank you. Representative Elam. No question. You're killing me over here.
Right name, just no questions. Thank you.
Any additional questions? Representative Underwood.
Thank you, through the chair. I mean, you were looking at me. I don't really have a question. I just wanted to always say that how much I love the Matt Sue. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here with us. We now are on to our last presentation, and I will let members know that if we do have time at the end of this presentation, we can bring back any additional speaker back up to the dais to ask questions that we were unable to ask during their particular presentation.
All right. Good morning, Madam Co-Chairs Tobin and Story. My name is Katie Parrott. I am the Senior Director of the Office of Management and Budget for Anchorage School District. I also serve as the President of the Alaska Association of School Business Officials. ALASBO, as we're known, is an affiliate of the Association of School Board Officials International. So we do network with people doing this work across the world. Our board members come from across the state representing rural and urban districts, municipal and REAA districts, as well as one seat on our board is an ex officio position that's appointed by deed. On this slide is our mission, vision, and values. Our members are the business, operations staff, finance, accounting, HR, IT, operations and maintenance. So the people that are doing some of the less fun work maybe than it happens in the classroom. But our mission really truly is to promote the highest standards in school business practice. Accountability and transparency really is the name of our game. We strive to uphold and maintain what we would describe as the compliance infrastructure of districts and to maintain best practices in resource management. And so as part of that responsibility, members of our organization are responsible for a whole lot of data tracking and financial and other kinds of accountability reporting. And so this slide is not a comprehensive list of all of those reports and responsibilities, but it takes account of many of those regular reporting requirements that we do have and that are listed here. In smaller districts, I think it's really important for you to know that this could be one single person who is responsible for completing and submitting all of these throughout the year. And so the stress and challenge sometimes of the reporting requirements and being compliant and on top of this is not insignificant. While business officials have tended not to see the kinds of rates of vacancy or turnover that we've seen in the classroom for many years, that's starting to change. change. We have some people who've been in positions for a very long time who are retiring, and we are seeing some concern about the vacancy rate and people coming up into these positions, especially as there's continued calls to cut back on administrative duties and administration as in the districts as a whole. The next slide is really kind of focusing on Alaska's finance and accounting standards. We do have what's called the Alaska Uniform Chart of Accounts that's required for us to utilize. This is by statute. And essentially what the Chart of Accounts does for us is it provides a structure and a categorization system for accounting for all expenditures. We are required to use this chart of accounts to categorize our budget areas and then to report on our actual expenditures. And essentially, this provides us the opportunity to provide an apples-to-apples comparison across all districts, as you know, that have a lot of differences. This slide demonstrates the financial data. This is audited financials for FY25 for school district operating expenditures. And there are a few things that I want to point out about this information. One is that there's an ongoing concern that not enough resource is being directed to instruction and that students in the classroom are not being prioritized. However, you can see from this slide that 75% of all of the expenditures made in FY25 were directed to instruction. And those are specific components within that chart of accounts within our budgets. Additionally, there's a lot of concern at times that our districts are top-heavy, that there is administrative positions that are not necessary, and that that's an area to scale back. However, you can see also from this chart that only 2% of all operating expenditures were directed to district administration, which is that top-level, high-level level of administration in the district. Another 5% is expended in 25 for district administrative support. And those are all of your payroll functions, your HR, IT, and those kinds of functions, many of which are actually legally required. There are positions in administration that we would not be in compliance with our legal requirements if we did not have those. Like reporting to the legislature. More and more, there are a lot of competing priorities eating into these slices of the pie, and so we're going to look at a couple of those next. Related to school district unfunded needs, on the left side of this slide, you see kind of a chart of an example of one district's attempts to bridge the budget gap between the BSA equivalent and then that inflationary rate that's kind of tracking above. And you see in prior years, districts have tried to fill those gaps in different ways to maintain certain programs and services in their districts. However, there's a lot that falls into that gap. And so this list below, curriculum, technology, CTE and vocational ed, fine arts, nurses, counselors, preschool, reading interventions, all of these good things we would love to be doing often fall out or are removed, eliminated from budgets because of that gap. And so we're making lots of decisions about how to provide instruction that are without a lot of strategies that would facilitate really great outcomes. Additionally, we have a changing student population, as you've heard in the prior presentation, so that shift from the shift in needs is also impacting the budget to the extent that we've had a lot of discussion about the enrollment decline in districts across the state. Enrollment decline over the last decade or so has been about 1.5%. However, our SPED population has increased by 14%. And so while there might be less students in some of our classrooms, some of the students in our classrooms have significant additional needs. And so we're working to try to maintain and meet those changing needs. And then in line with that, when we're talking about competition for those dollars that we're trying to allocate to meet student needs, there's other competing priorities. And you've heard a little bit about the deferred maintenance backlog that is a stress for a lot of districts. And one of the other areas that we're focused on is school bond debt reimbursement. ACSA really urges the legislature to reject a moratorium on school bond debt reimbursement. because of the fact that when we don't have that resource, many of our deferred school construction projects create an environment where our buildings are deteriorating in ways that are really truly becoming unsafe and not helpful for making sure that there's a positive learning environment for students and staff. And it does create higher costs for school districts. If you go to the next slide. This is something that I think we've showed you before, but just to reiterate, the issue is that when there's some resources that lag in one area, sometimes that increases costs in another area. So as we've seen the loss of state bond debt reimbursement, our facilities maintenance backlog has gone up significantly in the Anchorage School District, and some of that, some of those needs do compete with dollars going to the classroom. Next slide, please. Additionally, we are really concerned and tracking the impact of inflation and a flat funding on some of our student support services and those services that allow students to access their education, one of the major ones being pupil transportation funding. So it's truly imperative that the state does increase an inflation-proof funding for pupil transportation as one of the key strategies to address chronic absenteeism, make sure kids are getting to school, that they have equitable access. And the funding that's provided to support the service is about half of what the cost increases for running those programs has been over since about 2016, to the extent that statewide transportation costs have exceeded the amount of state funding for that program by over $65 million. So districts have shelled out about $65 million over a period of time to support pupil transportation in order to keep that going. And this next slide kind of demonstrates that in visual form. A couple of things to note as well is that some of our programs, one of them being transportation, has forces that are requirements that do cause costs to go up. So one of the things that's changed in pupil transportation is the implementation of ballot measure one. That has increased the wages by statute for some of our positions within transportation, and that's reflected in this slide, as well as fleet maintenance and replacement. So there's also rules and regulations around buses on the road and how those need to be updated and replaced to meet requirements to keep that service going. So all of these things really do impact the bottom line. When we receive flat funding or funding that isn't adjusted to match the cost of maintaining a service without some other change in the system, it really does require us to cut into what we're able to provide. And so that's the environment that our members are working in. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Parrott. I do have a question for you, Dr. Parrott, if you could follow up with us offline. While the task force is looking at ways to reform our pupil transportation system, we did learn that previous increases to pupil transport were based on actual expenditures by district. And if you could get us that information in the next few weeks, we are working on legislation to increase pupil transport, and we'd like to make it as accurate to current expenditures as possible. With that, do we have questions from committee members? I have Representative Hemshute, Representative Eichheit, Representative Schwanke, and Representative Bjorkman, or Senator Bjorkman.
I have two really quick questions through the chair. My first question is, in districts from Juneau to Ketchikan to Sitka, the annual audit is not turning up everything we need to know. So is there an annual audit, and what can we do differently to make sure that that tells us what we need to know in budgeting?
That's such a great question. Through the chair to Co-Chair Hemshute, yes, every district in the state is required to complete an annual audit and to submit those to the department. The department also produces publicly information on audited financials related to how we're spending funds. So those are currently published on the website. I think that there's a few things. One of the things that concerns me personally is a lot of districts have heeded the call for reducing administration costs. Some administrative teams in the finance and accounting world are too lean, at this point, to be quite frank. And so in order to really stay on top of best practices for tracking financial data, for forecasting, for projecting, and for communicating all of that to the local boards, you have to have the staff to be able to do that. And districts really have tried to respond to the public sentiment to prioritize the classroom at all costs. And I think one of the things that we've seen in the system is that it's had a cost. The other thing that makes it challenging is coming and going of certain kinds of revenues and expenditures that have some unpredictability. So building in some predictability to get way ahead of establishing your plan for the year is so critical for the finance and accounting staff and the business operations people in districts, because a lot of times there's chaos that's created when we go back and forth between different revenue and expenditure scenarios. So you have a situation where a district might establish a plan based on an expectation that the legislature is going to act a certain way or, you know, approve a certain level of funding. And a school board, a local school board that's elected to make those decisions, gives the direction that ends up changing through the process. So you can imagine the inefficiency that takes place when finance and accounting staff and school boards are having to change a budget three times before the start of the school year, and sometimes at the beginning of the school year. So I think that providing support for ensuring that districts have the staff they need to adequately track and maintain best practice standards is one thing. The other thing is creating some stability in the system.
Thank you. My second question. Very brief follow-up, as we are at 7 minutes and we have three people behind.
Apologies. Through the chair, I just want to confirm, when you said that districts are falling short on transportation, you're talking about that in aggregate, all the districts
yes.
together.
Yeah.
Okay.
Across
Thank you.
The state.
Thank you. Representative Eichheim.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Chair Tobin. My question was for Ms. Matthews, so I don't know if this is I can also wait if you want.
Sorry, if there are additional questions for Ms. Parrott, and then we will bring back Ms. Matthews.
Thank you, Chair Tobin, through the chair, to Ms. President Parrott. I'm looking at slide 64. And it's that little thin sliver of student activities at 1%. And I played basketball. I played volleyball. It kept, you know, it was like my favorite part of my high school tenure. And it's sad to see that at 1%. And when I look next door at instruction at 41%, which is great, but the previous presentation, it was roughly $27,000 to replace a teacher and train them. And then if you think of 10 teachers, that's $270,000. And then a principal, 10 new principals, is $750,000. This recruitment and retention is huge. And if we value after school and before school activities so that we can make that little sliver bigger of the pie, we need to really address that, because I know sports keeps kids in school, chronic absenteeism, it helps with all of that. So I just wanted to get that on the record, and that's where we need to really do the work.
Through the chair to Representative Dibert, that is such a wonderful point. That sliver is the operating fund expenditures that the districts are allocating to that. Our communities have a heavy lift in supporting our student activities, and I think we have asked our communities to pick up the tab on that through the years to maintain those opportunities for students. I personally am the parent to a student who student activities is the way he's graduating. That's the only way he's graduating. That's the way he's passing his classes, is to stay eligible for sports. I know that that keeps our kids engaged and working hard and doing things that are very difficult for them personally in order to participate in that. So that's something that we really care about. Unfortunately, when we're in a situation where we're picking and choosing, sometimes we're picking things that we're not legally required to provide. And that's really unfortunate.
Thank you. Thank you for that point. We do have a few questions, I am assuming, for folks who have already presented. I have on my list Representative Eichheit, Representative Schwanke, and Senator Bjorkman. I want to ensure that you guys have time, so I'm going to ask folks to keep your questions tight and your responses even tighter. Representative Eichheit, you were interested to hear from Ms. Matthews. Is that correct?
Affirmative. So I'll pose my question for Ms. Matthews. This goes to slide 45, if we can bring that back up. Slide 45 showed that, and through the Chair Tobin, a fairly rapid increase in special education students. And these are students that are legally owed appropriate education services. My question is, if the federal government is not paying up to 40% of that cost, and I don't think we can control them, and if these numbers keep increasing, would it be wise, in your opinion, for us to invest more money in early childhood education, specifically the early intervention services for age 0 to 3 that Alaska has a fairly high barrier to, unlike most states, to lower these special education numbers growing in the future?
Through the chair, Representative Eichheit. Yes, I do believe that, in my opinion, that if they invest more in the infant learning program specifically, that we would see a lot of that going down before they get into school. So even if it's infant learning, they come in and they're still maybe going to qualify for a little bit, I see that they're usually not on or in education or special education very long. They usually will test out eventually.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Turner. And we do know that if we invest the $5 million required to reduce our developmental delay to 25%, that the program for infant learning will pay for itself in about 6 years. With that, we have another question from Representative Schwanke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question for Ms. Parrott specifically on school finance issues. So last year when the operating budget passed, there was intent language in there that required, it said, that a school district shall report to the department twice annually, once by the end of the count period set out, and then once February 1st, 2026, the balance of each of the following funds, school operating funds, special revenue funds, capital project funds, other governmental funds, and then it also asked for other classifications, non-spendable fund balance, restricted fund balance, committed fund balance, assigned fund balance, unassigned balance. Were these reports done, and what kind of stress does that put on your administrators?
Yeah, thank you so much for the question. Through the chair to Representative Schwanke. Yes, these are required, so they're completed by staff to support these. Those reports are very difficult for staff because it's off cycle. Some of those reporting are off cycle from the way that districts normally would do business to compute some of that. And it's during a period of time when those numbers are in flux. So there's a lot of qualifications that districts provide when they're reporting on that, because it's like taking a snapshot of your bank account and reporting that to your family. Maybe for some districts that would be on the day that your check is deposited before your mortgage comes out or any other bills are paid. For some districts, it's coming in the cycle where they've paid all of their bills and they're waiting for a payment the next day. So it looks really different for different districts for different reasons. And that report specifically is very challenging for districts. So that's been one of the requests. If there was going to be a burden that was taken off of the reporting, that would be one that ALASBO members would request the legislature to change so that we didn't have to do that report, specifically because we don't feel that it provides the kind of information that the legislature really can use to make decisions.
Quick follow-up?
Very brief.
Okay. The reason I wanted to mention that specifically is I do think as a past school board member, it's very important for people to understand, especially like the capital fund accounts. I do believe a lot of districts have spent down those funds, mm-hmm. and we're getting into dangerous territory. And then my last suggestion is please make it as transparent as possible as far as not just state funds, but also federal funds. I know it was very hard as a school board member to get those numbers. So okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And our last question will be from Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for all the great questions and conversation today. Friday, I met with a group of six kids from River City Academy, a small charter school on the Kenai Peninsula, and their main ask was to advocate for their school and for me to help prevent their school from closing. I had to be very frank with them and say, I'm not sure that I'm going to be able to do that, but I'm going to work my hardest to make sure that you all have the educational opportunities that you need to be successful. How we do that inside of a formula that increases to shift costs from state government to local government for many districts is increasingly concerning to many districts. On the Kenai Peninsula, we're laser focused on that because although we passed a base student allocation increase of sizable proportions, effectively it only was $20 from the amount of money allocated the previous year. And for the school budget on the Kenai, it meant about $3.4 million less in state funds coming from the district. So it's fascinating to me to hear a little bit still about conversations of increasing the BSA when the BSA increase that we did last year resulted in a loss because of cost shifting to Anchorage of $7.3 million. Mm-hmm. To Fairbanks, almost $3
million. Senator Bjorkman, can you get to your question, please?
Yes, ma'am. Many members have had significant leeway to talk today. I have talked.
I recognize
this
that.
One
However,
time.
We are at 10:03, and thank I apologize. You, many folks have other obligations.
As we look forward to expressing and fixing our formula, I would ask that you all consider how we can address this issue. Many of these other issues are of significant concern, but none probably as much as this one. So if you could focus on that, that would be most excellent. Thank you.
I'm not sure there was a question, but if you'd like to comment.
Through the chair to Senator Bjorkman, that is definitely a concern that we have and share as well in talking about the cost shift and the rise of the local required contribution as well as the deductible impact aid portions that could really support districts doing some innovative things. So that those are all issues that we're tracking. We'd be happy to provide some additional information.
Thank you. And thank you for everyone who presented today. I appreciate folks being cognizant that we had multiple presenters and a short time to get through each slide deck, so I very graciously extend my thanks for your practicing beforehand. This concludes our agenda for today. The next meeting of the Senate Education Committee will be at 3:30 p.m. on Wednesday, April 1st. We will receive a presentation on the Alaska Native Language Center. The next meeting of the House Education Committee will be at 8 a.m. on Wednesday, April 1st, and they will be considering several bills, including Senate Bill 23 by President Stevens. As there is no other business before the committee today, I will adjourn this meeting of the House and Senate Education Committee at 10:05 a.m.